I am John Cryer, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. The third episode in our Chester Holman series, Testa-Lying, delved into two huge events that occurred after his conviction, the recantations of the two most important witnesses against him. And with us today is Colin Miller. He's one of the hosts of Undisclosed. He's also an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. He blogs at the Evidence Prof blog. He is also master of the palinode. Welcome to the show, Colin.
Hey,
are there any other obscure types of poetry that you intend on weaving into the podcast? Just like haikus? Are we gonna hit that at some point?
Maybe a limerick here.
We do
an Irish case.
The limerick episode is going to be a doozy. Well, actually, as you've just heard, we also have with us Emily Lounsbury and Mikhail Bond. Now, Emily Lounsbury is an associate professor of journalism at the College of New Jersey, and after more than two decades as a staff writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer, where she primarily wrote about the law, examined issues with criminal justice, and covered trials. Mikhail Bond is a New Jersey native and a reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News. She spent 3.5 years covering crime, courts, government, and community in Chester County, Pennsylvania, before starting her current beat. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
So you guys wrote the article entitled Testa-Lying, which got the attention of the Undisclosed team and actually brought them to the Chester Holman case. What brought Chester to your attention?
Actually, an editor here at the Inquirer, while he was a reporter back in 2012, he actually had been in the courtroom when Deirdre Jones recanted her testimony. And he was kind of struck by what had happened in the case, and he asked if we would take a look at it.
So did this seem like typical of many cases of this kind of thing in Philadelphia, or was this an outlier?
It's just a curious case. It's kind of hard to characterize it, but because both witnesses had recanted, it attracted our attention.
Mm-hmm. And also our editor, who had sat in on Deirdre Jones's recantation in 2012, he was also struck by how quickly the judge in the case dismissed her statements as falsehoods the second time around. So he was expecting kind of a long, drawn-out hearing where they'd come back from lunch and have a whole rest of the day to talk about the case and kind of grill Deirdre Jones. But he was struck by how quickly the judge said that, she's lying this time. She was telling the truth the first time, and that's all she needed to hear.
And was this the proceeding where the Dawkins testimony was not brought in because they couldn't get a continuance?
Correct.
Which I think that surprised a lot of listeners, that a judge would be so dismissive of a corroborating recantation. Did the judge at that time give any reason for not granting a continuance? I mean, it seems like you know where the guy is. He's in jail. He's not hard to locate. So what was her reasoning? Just that the trial was taking too long?
It was kind of unclear what her thinking was on that point. But she had essentially already decided that Deirdre Jones was not credible. And once a judge in that kind of circumstances reaches that kind of a conclusion, it definitely hurts the defense position.
Yeah, John, go ahead.
The courts had already decided that Andre Dawkins had lied in court about his criminal record. So they were already kind of thinking that he wasn't the most reliable witness because of that prior decision that he was lying originally. So he wasn't the kind of best person to hang a case on. So they were really relying on whether they were thinking Deirdre Jones was telling the truth this time or not, and the judge decided she wasn't.
Yeah, and John, in terms of that continuance, I'm reading here, this is the opinion of the Superior Court of Pennsylvania. They find the reason that they didn't continue was the case had already been continued 13 times over 2 years. At least 8 of those delays were at Holman's request. Further, the court found that Holman failed to demonstrate due diligence in arranging for the witness's attendance. So basically, the court is saying, look, there's been a lot of delays already. We don't want to delay again. And they say it's your fault, which is really the attorney's fault that you haven't made Mr. Dawkins present, and we're going to therefore penalize you and say you're not allowed to present him when we're not going to grant you another continuance.
Well, I'd love to hear the reasoning from Chester's attorney as to why they weren't able to do that.
Yeah, and I think that the attorney probably would have a different interpretation of those facts than the court. It's something we ran into in the Terrence Lewis case as well, where it was sort of similar facts. And so, yeah, it would be interesting to see what they say about that.
Yeah, we did get a lot of comments from people just commenting on the incredible length of the proceedings. Rabia went into just the enormous number of proceedings and all of those taking fully 6 years for him to get an actual time before a judge. Is that typical?
Yes, it is. Cases can go on and on and on and on. And that's just the nature of appellate cases involving murders in Pennsylvania and in federal courts, too. It's a very circuitous route, and it takes quite a while.
So you guys actually got to talk with Deirdre and Dawkins. So how did you feel about their testimony after speaking with them personally?
They were very sincere. They were clearly haunted by the testimony that they had given back in 1993 and even before that. So it was very interesting to hear that.
It was. And they both told us when we talked to them for the story about kind of the effects that they felt because of their original testimony. Deirdre said that she felt depressed, and Andre was saying that it was hard for him to sleep at night and things like that, thinking about this case. So those kind of little kind of tidbits they told us about their time since they first testified led us to believe that, like Emily said, they were sincere in what they were saying to us the second time that they lied originally at the trial.
And Dawkins seemed to be, because he brought up the fact that he had been an addict and that he had cleaned up his life substantially, that this was also an aspect of him turning over a new leaf. Was that an aspect of it when you spoke with him?
Definitely. He really said over and over again, over numerous interviews, that he does not want to go to his grave with this on his conscience.
So in the piece, you actually mentioned several other cases of people who were exonerated after false witness testimony. Did you see any, were there any patterns that came out from that? Did you see, you know, people whose names just kept popping up in terms of prosecutors or police officers?
There were some really good, really great trial lawyers in the district attorney's office during the same time frame. But I think Mikhail and I agree that it's not so much the pattern of cases, so much as what was happening in Philadelphia back at that time. There had just been a huge homicide rate in Philadelphia, and homicide detectives had to be feeling the pressure to solve these cases.
So you didn't feel like that we're dealing with, you know, a rogue cop in particular who's just leaving a trail of wrongfully convicted people?
I don't think I would characterize it that way.
So you would feel like these things were just sort of individual acts of circumstance, that, you know, there was a confluence of events that happened, you know, a few things went against the defendant and suddenly they found themselves in this terrible predicament?
Well, I don't know that I would say that either. I mean, Philadelphia was, it was a different city back in those days. And there were just a lot of things that were happening back then. And the city also does have a history of police corruption.
Yes, many of our listeners, after we had a former ADA from the Philadelphia office came on last week, they mentioned that, you know, the obviously Mumia Abu-Jamal case, and they mentioned the MOVE tragedy, and they mentioned some recent arrests I believe their most recent district attorney is in prison now. So do you feel like Philadelphia is dealing with issues that other places aren't, or that this is just, you know, something that all police departments are dealing with now?
I don't know quite how to answer that. You know, you have to understand the history of Philadelphia, and it's, you know, there's been a lot of bad events in that history, whether it's, you know, corruption at various levels, the MOVE bombing that you mentioned. It's just a city that has had a lot of problems over the years, and it's been quite difficult to solve those problems.
That's an understatement, it sounds like.
Hims is a new wellness brand for men, and it's based upon a simple premise that I'm sure most of you will recognize to be true. Far too many men don't take care of themselves. We're not proactive about our health, and when we start feeling aches and pains, or even worse, far too often we don't want to admit to ourselves that we need to see a doctor, or don't want the inconvenience or sometimes embarrassment of getting the medical care we need. Hims is filling that need with a user-friendly website that lets you connect with doctors and get the prescriptions you need, all from the convenience of your computer or tablet. Hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and sexual wellness for men. They have medical-grade solutions and real doctors offering well-known generic equivalents to name-brand prescriptions. These aren't herbal supplements, they're prescription solutions backed by science. And there's no waiting room, no awkward doctor's visits. You can save hours by going to 4hims.com. Just answer a few quick questions, and a doctor will review your file and talk with you and prescribe you the medications you need, which come directly to your door. And you can follow up with that same doctor once you've started your treatment regime. The first thing that Hims is tackling is hair loss. 66% of men lose their hair by age 35. And when you start to notice hair loss, it's too late. But now, my listeners can get a trial month of everything you need to keep your hair for just $5 today, right now, while supplies last. See the website for full details. Just go to 4hims.com/undisclosed. That's forhims.com/undisclosed. 4hims/undisclosed.
So, Colin, I was told that that the Innocence Project actually did a study of recantation cases. What were their findings?
Yeah, this is pretty interesting. This was done in 2013. They found, when you're looking at cases of wrongful convictions based upon recantations, there's two categories of crimes that dominate the statistics. So 82% of cases where convictions have been thrown out based upon recantations are composed of murder and child sex abuse. And so those are the two big categories. But there are differences between the two, which are interesting, in that in murder cases, there's much longer time between the testimony and the recantation, whereas in the child sex abuse cases, it's a much shorter time. And also, and this sort of goes right to the Holman case, in the child sex abuse cases, that testimony, of course, usually by the victim, was central to the conviction, and therefore in a much higher percentage of cases leads to the conviction being thrown out. Whereas in the murder case, it's often found, as in the Holman case, that it wasn't as important, and therefore it's a much smaller percentage of cases where those convictions are thrown out based upon recantations.
So I'm confused. You're saying that the recantations that happen in the sexual abuse cases tend to happen a lot sooner after post-conviction?
Exactly.
And these are generally the victims who are recanting. In other words, they're saying this abuse did not, in fact, occur.
Yeah, and that's true. And a big chunk of that is, this is something which I had kind of forgotten about, but was reminded on when I had read this study again, is that in the 1980s and early 90s, there was this whole thing known as the daycare sex abuse hysteria, where people were thinking these daycare facilities were having a lot of child sex abuse, and it led to a lot of these allegations and charges being brought. And that is a significant percentage of those child sex abuse cases where there were later recantations and those convictions being thrown up. But yeah, typically those happened a lot more quickly than the cases in which eyewitnesses in murder cases, or in this case, alleged accomplices, recanted their testimony.
But it was great having Candace Horsey on last week, who was a former ADA in Philadelphia, because she brought in the idea, and I introduced the idea, and a lot of people, as I said, had issues with the episode last week. But she introduced the idea that ADAs on a daily basis, and police officers and everybody involved in the justice system, deal with people changing their stories all the time, from the grand jury to the actual trial to recanting after the fact, and that because that situation is so fluid, it leads to prosecutors and judges feeling tending to discount stuff that happens post-trial. The idea being that it was so fluid to begin with, how can we possibly, on a practical level, have any integrity to a case if people can change what they say, post-conviction? And I thought that was a valuable perspective. And certainly made sense in terms of, like, say, organized crime, which, you know, if you think about it, in that situation, people who testify as to one particular fact, once a trial is done, they may be put pressure on them by, you know, other elements of a criminal gang or a criminal organization and suddenly, you know, change what they said. So I could see why prosecutors and judges might have that attitude.
And I think you probably kind of focused right back on the Holman situation. If you put the Holman case in the context of what you were just saying, people lie in the justice system all the time. And it's just the sad, simple truth of where we are in the justice system. And judges, I'm sure, get rather frustrated, and prosecutors too. So it's not easy. It's not easy on anybody.
Yeah, and John, my research in this area hasn't been some recanting witnesses, but it's similar considerations. It is jurors who come forward after the trial and admit to some type of misconduct, whether that be researching the case online, whether that be using drugs during deliberations or getting drunk. And we have this rule of evidence, Federal Rule of Evidence 606B, that says generally jurors aren't allowed to come in after a verdict and impeach their testimony. And a big consideration is we're worried if we didn't have this prohibition that the losing party, their friends, dangerous people might come to the jurors after the trial and try to threaten them, intimidate them, coerce them, incentivize them to change their testimony. And that's, I think, what Candace was saying last week. Similar to that is you have the prosecutor, this person's testified under oath, the person's been convicted. And yeah, in some cases, we think in this case, absolutely, the recantation is genuine and legitimate. And you want those recantations to lead to bad convictions being thrown out. But the problem is we do have bad actors in the system. And that's the concern is you might have someone coming in after the fact and using improper means to influence a person to have a fake recantation.
So, Emily and Mikhail, did you ever get to meet Detective Baker, the officer in question in terms of Deirdre Jones's testimony?
We did not meet with him in person, but I spoke with him over the phone for about 2 hours. And so we did feel it was very important based on what Deirdre told us about her perspective about being coerced into giving her first statement. Given that, we thought it was very important to get Detective Baker's side of the story and see what he remembered of the case and his conduct.
It sounded like in the article that he was downplaying his participation, that he, in fact, was saying he just took down her statement, that he said other officers may have talked to her and, you know, may have given her other impressions, but that he just took down her statement. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes. He said that he was called in later on in that morning to take her statement, and that's what he was called in to do, and he said that's what he did. He said he could not speak to what other officers might have told her about what Chester had said or any ties to any criminal activity they said Chester might have had. He just said he came in, took her statement, he said verbatim what she said, typed it all down, and had her sign it.
So it's possible, if he's in fact telling the truth, that other officers may have, told her about Chester's supposed mob ties and coerced her in the ways that she claimed. Or Colin, I don't recall if she claimed that it was specifically Detective Baker who did that.
I'm trying to remember. Yeah, I mean, it's the reason
it's unclear.
Yeah.
You know, we interviewed her a couple of times, and she was not clear on names of, you know, which detective said what to her.
The only thing that surprised me about Detective Baker's testimony was that he claimed she was not scared. And to me, I would be scared either way. You know, if I was an innocent person who got picked up by police and was being interrogated for a long time, I'd be scared. If I was, say, involved in a robbery, tangentially, and was being interrogated by the police, I'd also be scared. I didn't understand why he felt the need to say she wasn't scared. I guess the idea was that he was trying to say she wasn't coerced. Would that be correct?
Yes, that was the point that he was trying to make, is that if the police did try to scare her, that she would be scared about Chester's reported mob ties, according to them, and that she should fear for her life, and that's why she was coerced into giving the statement. So, according to Detective Baker, if she was scared, if she was outwardly feeling scared and showing her fright, then that would back up the fact that she was coerced by the police.
I know Chester mentioned that Detective Pyrie actually struck him. Is that the kind of thing that you guys get that gets reported to you guys as beat reporters, or is that something that sounds out of the ordinary?
There have been accusations in other cases about other detectives. Yes, there have been those kinds of accusations. It wouldn't be unusual to hear that.
I had another question for Colin, actually. So was the jury informed about the plea deal that Andre Dawkins claimed he had?
They were not. And that was, I think we'll probably get into this a little bit more in the last episode, or certainly the addendum. One of the claims on appeal was a claim of a Brady violation, that information related to Dawkins was not turned over to the defense. And so that was one of the things they were claiming we didn't receive, and this was pertinent for the jury to know.
So that was a Brady violation that I guess was that dismissed by a judge?
Right, exactly. The judge on appeal found that whatever evidence the prosecution did not turn over to the defense was not material, in the sense that it would not have undermined our confidence in the jury's verdict. So even if there was evidence that wasn't disclosed, it wasn't important enough.
Huh. I wonder when that judgment was made, because a lot of the time, you know, these things happen incrementally. It's like you get one recantation and then you get another recantation, you know, years later. Very often it's the totality of the case that convinces a judge, oh, OK, there's enough circumstantial evidence that I don't need these these recantations don't count because the circumstantial evidence is so strong. But in this case, there wasn't much circumstantial evidence.
I mean, there was no physical evidence at all. There was no DNA, not a fingerprint, no forensic evidence at all, which is also one of the reasons that made the Holman case so interesting to look at, because increasingly, with all the scientific advancements brought about by DNA testing and everything, the expectation nowadays is that there will be some kind of physical evidence, and there's just nothing in this case.
Yes, in this case, the CSI effect did not seem to take place. Often juries are accused of employing the CSI effect, the expectation that they need definitive scientific proof of a person's guilt before they can find in that case. But in this case, it sounds like the jury was really relying on the eyewitness accounts.
Yes,
that's right.
And the license plate, which we'll address in more detail in episode 4.
So, Colin, when the judge refused to grant the continuance to bring Andre Dawkins in to testify to corroborate Deirdre's testimony, was that ever appealed, that continuance was not granted?
Yeah, it was appealed. And essentially, the court found there was no abuse of discretion in the lower court, basically saying this case had been continued many times. And what they also found was, and this relates back to what we were just discussing about the detective's testimony, they found that Dawkins' testimony really isn't corroborating Deirdre's recantation, in the sense that their conclusion as the court after this hearing is, look, the detective came in and said, I didn't know the details of this crime. And so how in the world could Deirdre how could I have conveyed these facts to her to include in her confession? This must be something that, in fact, she was part of and organically confessed to. Now, as we were noting, Deirdre did say that other detectives were giving her information, but in essence, they're saying, at one, this was a case where the court was fully within their discretion to not allow another continuance, and two, in terms of materiality, even though I think, you know, on a common sense level, it doesn't seem to make much sense. Their point is that even though he's recanting, that recantation isn't really helping to prove that her recantation is valid and credible.
Got it. So he's saying that one does not necessarily reinforce the other.
Right. These are sort of two independent strands, and his recantation isn't corroborating or reinforcing hers, which, you know, I think is certainly debatable, and I would probably disagree with it, but that's at least the logic that was used by the court.
Mm-hmm. So what happened to Tiffany? Has anybody been able to get in touch with her?
That is something where I know people were very recently hoping to speak with her. So I hope we'll have some audio from her in episode 4. I know that was something they were trying to get, and I haven't heard yet, but I think they were trying to get that, and we're hopefully getting it.
Yeah, because obviously if she stands by her testimony, that would be a pretty important fact.
Correct. And of course, if people have spoken with her or are going to, it would be very interesting to say what she has to say about you know, the bottom, this statement is a lie that she crossed out, exactly what led to that.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get around to what's going on in Philadelphia now. Obviously, there is a new DA, Larry Krasner, and he's already ruffled some feathers. He fired 31 of prosecutors within the first week in office. We had some illuminating conversations with Candace Horsey about that, who brought up some of the problems with doing that kind of thing. Mikhail, you're sort of still on the beat there in Philadelphia. Are you noticing any sort of changes in the air?
Definitely in perception, if nothing else. The idea that defense attorneys are thinking this is their shot. So we're expecting a flood of new filings and letters to the DA's office, and specifically the conviction review unit, to take another look at a lot of these cases, because they're thinking, okay, we've got Larry Krasner in there, friendly DA, this is their chance to get another look at these cases. So we are seeing, so far, some have trickled in. We're expecting a lot more petitions to the DA's office.
Yes, I would imagine, you know, a guy who's just gotten into office and already, you know, made some fairly big changes, he's got to be deluged with, you know, input at this point with everybody. He just apparently got rid of bail, cash bail at this point. Colin, did this just happen literally today or yesterday? Was it yesterday?
This happened today. Within the last hour, he's calling it phase one of bail reform in Philadelphia. And that is, he is eliminating cash bail for misdemeanor cases and some nonviolent felonies. It's expected to affect about 4,000 cases. And in essence, what their study has found, and other studies in similar jurisdictions like New Orleans have had similar things, is that a huge chunk of people who are detained because they can't post bail are, of course, poor. They're often minorities, and it's costing cities like Philadelphia and New Orleans more than $10 million a year. And many of these are cases where the offense is relatively minor. Many of them are cases where the charges are eventually dropped. Many of them are cases where eventually they plead out to time served. And so these are cases where people's lives are being disrupted. They can't see loved ones. They lose their jobs. And, you know, again, there are certainly cases where it makes sense to detain a person pending trial because they're a danger to the community. They're a flight risk, et cetera. But what Krasner has done with this is to say, for these lower level offenses, we're not going to keep people locked up because they can't afford to pay sometimes relatively small amounts of money.
Yeah, I think most people, most average people, you know, who haven't experienced the criminal justice system, don't understand that a whole industry has arisen around cash bail. That once that type of industry sort of arises, it becomes kind of entrenched. It's hard for DAs to get rid of it. I'll just leave it at that. But again, a lot of people's hopes are riding on Larry Krasner right now. So, Emily, your profile page indicates that your current research interests include mandatory minimum sentences. What have you been researching on that subject?
Actually, I've done a good amount of research, but I've not yet published anything on mandatory minimums in DUI cases. And if you look at mandatory minimums for other cases, the research suggests that the mandatory minimums don't often, or at least don't always, get imposed. But the writing of the DUI laws is so airtight that it's almost 100% enforced. So it's kind of a corner on that research. More of my research has been on the impact of science on the law.
Oh, okay. So, yeah.
You
so
sure
here, yes, exactly. Here I am pontificating about the CSI effect. So, yes, please. What are you finding most fascinating about that?
Well, DNA has become the great equalizer in the justice system because obviously it can help convict the guilty, but it can also be used to help clear the innocent. And what we've learned over the years now from DNA is that other areas of the justice system that we thought were highly reliable are just not terribly reliable. One example is eyewitness identification. And it turns out that even though that eyewitness testimony is so incredibly powerful to a jury, that sometimes eyewitnesses just something happens in the course of a crime, especially if there's a gun involved, that you may well think that you remember the face of that person, but it just doesn't work out that way. So arson investigation, science has really changed how arson fires are investigated. And there's been some interesting research and efforts to help the justice system in these areas. And I find that very fascinating because science, of course, is so important, but the law moves a lot slower than science does.
I've heard that even, you know, science that's regarded as absolutely traditional in criminal investigations, like fingerprints, aren't even nearly as reliable as they had been assumed to be. Is that true?
That's one of the areas of scrutiny, but I don't think that fingerprint questions are as problematic as the whole eyewitness identification area. But with fingerprints, of course, it depends on how many points of comparison can be made. And so, I mean, there is science involved in that as well. But definitely there are some questions in that area.
And are you studying the effects on juries, like on how they interpret scientific evidence?
Yes. I mean, we've been talking about the CSI effect, and, you know, that effect really wasn't around at the time of Chester Holman's trial back in 1993. That was sort of the early days, probably, of Law and Order. I don't remember exactly when that first came out.
Colin probably knows.
Now,
1990?
Yeah. Okay, so it actually was around. But I think over the years, jurors have become much more interested in seeing science and seeing DNA and wanting to have some kind of forensic evidence. I mean, it's almost an expectation.
And I think often in trials, you end up with dueling experts, you know, basically marshaling different areas of science to try and justify either side. Is that something that's happening more and more?
I don't know if it's happening more and more. I've certainly seen it happen. And, you know, once again, we're back to the justice system. And, you know, is it really a search for the truth? Sometimes I wonder about that. So occasionally you will have cases where it does come down to dueling experts, one on one side and one on the other side. And I'm sure it must be very difficult and challenging for jurors to try to separate that out.
Audible is a leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. Audible helps you listen to more books by letting you switch seamlessly between devices, picking up exactly where you left off. Whether it's on your phone, through your car, from a tablet, or at home on an Amazon Echo, you can get through tons of books, both hands-free and eyes-free, while doing almost anything. Audible members get a credit every month good for any audiobook in their store, regardless of price, and unused credits roll over to the next month. Didn't like your audiobook? You can exchange it, no questions asked. Plus, your books are yours to keep. With Audible, you can go back and re-listen at any time, even if you cancel your membership. Now, recently I used Audible to listen to a book that should be right up the alley of our listeners. It's The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist by Radley Belko and Tucker Carrington. Belko's a reporter for The Washington Post, and Carrington is the head of the Innocence Project at the University of Mississippi School of Law. And the book focuses upon the wrongful convictions of LaVon Brooks and Kennedy Brewer based upon concocted bite mark evidence by a medical examiner and a dentist. And the book asks the questions, how many other innocent men are out there? Now you can listen to this book and other great audiobooks on Audible, and that's because Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/UA and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. You can download a title for free and start listening. It's that easy. So go to audible.com/UA or text UA to 500-500 to get started today.
I had a question for you guys as journalists. Well, obviously, Colin and I are podcasters, and that's a whole new genre that is kind of shaking up, you know, how people perceive true crime and how people perceive crime reporting. How do you feel about all these, you know, citizen journalists who are sort of coming into the field?
Well, I think everyone has everyone who reports to have the mission of informing others, reporting the news, has to have some standards. And I think everyone has a responsibility to be responsible in that telling of the news. So in a couple of these blogs and podcasts and things like that, it's incumbent on anyone who does that to make sure they do their research, you guys have done, do your research, talk to the people involved, get both sides as best as you can, or multiple sides, there's not, often not just one side or another, get multiple points of view. I think that's the same kind of standards that we employ as journalists should translate to other people who are trying to tell other people's stories.
I definitely agree. And, you know, I teach young journalists these days, and I always try to say, you know, we really need to focus on what are the facts. If you can figure out what the facts are, that may well lead you to the truth. And that would be amazing if we can do that kind of reporting. But I also tell them, and, you know, it's sort of the culture, at least of the Philadelphia Inquirer, where we do try to be very clinical and really test our theories and try to really, really have some standards and really, but focusing always on the facts, which can be quite elusive.
So do you guys feel like there are any, do you have any advice for wannabe podcasters out there? Just always concentrate on the fact? Is that pretty much what it all boils down to?
I mean, I think we're seeing it right here with you guys. I mean, clearly you have pulled files, you have read opinions. I mean, that's what journalists do. You know, that's what we've done in this case. So, you know, I think the mission is to inform the public of important things and to try to tell the stories that are so crucial. I mean, we're so lucky to have this thing called the First Amendment. But as Mikhail was saying, you know, we have a real responsibility to try to really uphold the standards, you know, especially nowadays when, you know, we're kind of under attack. So we really need to get it right and be fair and focus on the facts. I mean,
and I would also add, you know, to be upfront with people. If there's something that you don't know or is unclear, just tell them that this is what we don't know. This is, you know, what we haven't been able to get yet, but we're trying to get it. Don't make the facts or cherry pick certain facts and make them fit your narrative. Lay them all out there. I know you kind of on the ground reporting, Emily and I were, you know, going to multiple addresses of places of people we were trying to talk to. There was one time you went to an address and the house wasn't there. It was just an empty space and it had actually been demolished before we'd gotten there, a time before we got there. So things like that where just do the work, like Emily was saying, pull the records, go talk to people. There was one part when we were doing our research where we were wondering about the getaway route. And we had a lot of questions around that, about whether there was enough time for the vehicle that the cab driver saw driving from the scene would be able to get, it was enough time between that shooting and to get to where Chester and Deirdre were found and pulled over by police. One early morning around 1 a.m., which is around what the time the shooting happened, I drove the same route and we timed it. And multiple times we did that to try to see how long it might take. And that even wasn't enough. So after we did that, we employed a forensic consulting firm. They do kind of car accident reconstructions and things like that. So they were able to use math and formulas to figure out, given the route that we know that they took and then filling in a little bit of the rest, did they have time to get to that position? So we used all of those methods to try to get at, well, did they have enough time? And it turned out at the end of the day that they could have, you know, mm-hmm. We didn't come to a definitive there's been a conclusion there, because depending on if there was construction at the time, which we decided we didn't know whether there was construction, that would have slowed things down. We tried to figure it out, but the city didn't know. Things like that. There were so many different factors just in that one piece with the getaway route that we tried to get to that we just ultimately, there was no concrete answer on.
That took like months to resolve that. So, you know, and that's like the great thing about journalism and reporting is that, you know, we get to try to answer these major questions. And, you know, we used up some shoe leather. I mean, we were really out there. But it's so important to really try to figure these things out.
One thing that surprised me about print journalism and online journalism is it hasn't yet taken advantage of the long form aspect as much as I would like. I thought Testifying was a terrific article, and I could have taken another couple of pages on that, frankly.
We love you.
I'm serious, because that's the beauty of the web. And, you know, these things can be as long as they need to be. And I've never understood why editors don't take advantage of that. I mean, obviously, nobody likes a sloppily, you know, a lengthy piece that's, you know, sloppy and just includes extraneous, you know, bull that nobody really needs. But, you know, one of the things that people love about these podcasts is that they can do much deeper dives than a journalist is allowed to do.
Yeah, I mean, we're hoping that as the shift continues from print-based to online, that, you know, long form will still rule the day, and that we do get a chance to do more of these kinds of things.
Because obviously you guys put a huge amount of effort into finding what unfortunately turned out to be kind of unknowable, because you can't, you know, duplicate the conditions of that time, but as much as you could. But again, you know, that I don't even remember that being mentioned in Testifying. You know, and I think that would have been an important.
No.
Yeah.
We do a lot of background work that doesn't make it into the final piece. You just see the kind of conclusion with, they could have had enough time, they could not have. But yeah, on the back end for listeners, there's a lot that goes into every sentence, really, of what we wrote.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, again, what you have proven in that particular case is it is reasonable that the police felt like they had the right person. You know, I can certainly see why officers, if I had been given the exact same set of information that they were given, would have felt like, you know, Chester is the likely guy. And obviously all these witnesses have slightly different stories. Yeah, he's wearing different pants. She describes shorts. But, you know, this is all close enough, because, you know, what are the odds that there would be another Chevy Blazer with those plates anywhere nearby? Obviously, it turns out there was, but, you know, but I can totally see the officer's thought process in that particular thing. And it also explains why some of them might have been employing improper procedures. You know, if they're convinced that this is just a matter of, you know, having the case, having the information comport to making this guy who is clearly guilty actually provably guilty, you can understand why cops would cut corners in that situation. You know, I don't approve of it. But I'm saying you can understand the thought process that might be occurring to officers and prosecutors at that time. And actually, I wanted to get to our listener questions and comments. And obviously, if you guys want to comment on them, you're welcome to. But it was very interesting. Last week, we had on a former ADA from Philadelphia, Candace Horsey. And a lot of people, you know, were surprised to hear sort of the other side of, you know, how a prosecutor feels about a lot of these things. A former prosecutor who's now, by the way, a professor. Like we got Colleen Daly, who said, loved hearing another perspective. I think this is something that has been missing from the podcast for a long time. And I truly respect y'all for showing more gray and more POVs. Thank you, Candace Horsey. We also got a great addendum episode. Love the comparison of UK versus USA rights and interpretations of Lady Justice. Fascinating perspective. I'm reading the good ones, but we also got a lot of negative ones. We got someone who said, only 13 minutes into this episode and I'm having to turn this woman off. Why do you have an American woman on to explain the UK justice system? Well, because she actually worked in both systems, and we thought her perspective might be helpful. And why do Americans continue to insist that theirs is the best in the world? I'm I'm not one of those Americans, but and actually, I was curious to speak with Candace about whether the UK system might have a better means of handling wrongful convictions. I don't know, Colin, was that your question as well?
Yeah, and I, you know, as someone who myself hasn't practiced over there in the UK, I really appreciated her perspective. And as someone who hasn't worked in Philadelphia and certainly hasn't really had direct involvement with the DA's department, I really appreciated her take on that. And so, I mean, I can certainly understand some of the negative responses by listeners. And I mean, that's kind of why we had her on. And I think that's also why people appreciate it, is we very much, just in our nature, I think, the three of us in presenting the podcast are defense centric. And we often try to reach out to police officers and prosecutors. And for a variety of often good reasons, they're not willing to participate in the podcast. So I thought it was really valuable to have someone who was in this very office that had prosecuted the same types of cases as the four cases we've been handling to give their perspective. And, you know, I don't necessarily agree with Candace on a lot of points, but I appreciate her perspective and think she has a wealth of knowledge about both the UK system and the Philadelphia system that I appreciated.
Yeah, she also took pains to mention that she was speaking of her experience as an ADA. So, you know, it's a very large organization. It's possible that she didn't come in contact with officers who were cutting corners or prosecutors that were hiding, you know, hiding evidence and such. She've said that a few times during the course of the podcast. We also got a comment from Robin Gilbertson, who said, probably most of us know that a large number or most police officers and DAs are honest, overworked, fine people. But it's not them that Undisclosed is about. It only takes a few to totally destroy lives. And that's what's being exposed in these podcasts. She also said, isn't the UK justice system somewhat off topic? And I believe we've answered that. But I think that's a good point. You know, if as Candace was saying, it was kind of the few, you know, it's just a few bad apples situation. A few bad apples can leave a pretty awful legacy. And can, you know, if you're talking about somebody's whole career as a law enforcement officer, if a lot has been going wrong, that's a lot of lives that could be ruined. So I thought that was certainly a good point. Here, Solomon Garber says, I am only 10 minutes in, and what is this episode? Has this guest even heard of the Philadelphia police and prosecutors? We're talking about a city that literally bombed itself in 1985. Anyone who wants to know the reality of ethics of the Philadelphia prosecutors and police, assuming they haven't been keeping up with Undisclosed, should keep in mind Mumia Abu-Jamal and the ongoing injustices, which are far too vast to reasonably summarize here. So, you know, obviously people felt that Candace was underplaying the larger issues that the Philadelphia Police Department has. And finally, I wanted to get to Rhea Narancic, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Please forgive me if I'm not. But she mentioned, by the way, I'm assuming Rhea is female. I apologize again if I'm wrong, but saying, why did you not challenge anything Candace Horsey said? She came on to preach about how you and, by extension, the public unfairly judge the whole system for a few rotten apples and shit on the UK system, and said outright lies and some really telling twists on the truth. Things like the DA office really stress the importance of avoiding any appearance of impropriety, not impropriety itself. That sounds like nitpicking of the language, but that really suggests that the most important thing was the appearance, not ethics. And I thought that was a fair point to make. You know, again, I think, you know, we're on a podcast. We're making our points as eloquently as we can. And my interpretation of what Candace was saying at that time was she was saying that it was actual ethics, not merely the appearance. But I could be misinterpreting what she said. But Rhea makes a very good point here. And she says, and then you come to witness recantation. How hypocritical can you be? You claim that witnesses can be enough to convict somebody, but they often change their mind. And also, you can't trust them when it's about a police officer, even when it comes from another policeman. Which is it? Which I think is a terrific point. They're saying that that how come we value only the stuff that is said in the trial in front of everybody? If it's all lousy, why is that the stuff that we put all of our weight on? And I think that's a fair question.
Yeah, and I think, John, you know, you mentioned this before. I very much do agree with you that I think Candace said she was expressing her opinion as someone who's practiced in the UK and her experience personally in working in the district attorney's office. And, you know, I think that's valid to have her share her perspective. It wasn't sort of, at least the way I envisioned it, something where it would be a debate and going back and forth where it was sort of, this is wrong or this is right. It was, this is very much her experience. And that might be something that other people in that office had different experiences. It might be people on the other side of the law. people who are being prosecuted or know people who are prosecuted have a very different experience. But I just thought it was sort of Candace sharing her experience. This is what she experienced and is taken away from it. And yeah, I think, again, as I said before, I think I would probably disagree with some of it and agree with some of it. And certainly I can understand the listeners on the one hand who said, this is great to hear this whole new perspective we haven't heard. And I can understand the listeners coming in and saying, you know, I really disagree with some of the points that she made.
From Audioboom comes Mafia, a brand new podcast taking us into America's criminal underworld, exploring the lives and careers of the most powerful gangsters the world has ever seen. Through extensive research and eyewitness stories, Mafia reveals what life was really like inside the mob from the people who lived it. Every Wednesday, Mafia dives into the larger-than-life stories of mobsters and introduces us to the key figures who brought them down. In season one, host Fleet Cooper takes us closer than ever to the most notorious mob bosses of all time by taking us inside the lives of Sam Giancana, Dutch Schultz, Bugsy Siegel, Charles Lucky Luciano, John Gotti, and Donnie Brasco, discovering how they built their criminal enterprises and revealing how the mafia is connected to the assassination of JFK. So to make sure you don't miss a single episode of Mafia, subscribe to Mafia on Apple Podcasts and every other listening destination.
And here, Anne S., who says, I wanted to hear someone convince me or explain why prosecutors can believe in the system in Philadelphia and Baltimore, et cetera, but using the gun trace task force convictions to demonstrate the system is working, I'm going to pass. And that was a point that Candace made at one point, that the fact that there are mechanisms in place that create, say, this list that was revealed in Philadelphia of 26 problem officers that prosecutors were suggested not to put on the stand. She said that and the conviction of the gun trace task force people in Baltimore was actually an indication that the system was working to a greater or lesser extent. And, you know, it's a hard call, because you can say, OK, there's a police department where there's been no convictions of that kind of nature. Is that just because they're hiding it really well? Or, you know, it seems like Baltimore is certainly the undisclosed investigation of Freddie Gray's death. It seems like the Baltimore situation is a larger systemic issue to me. I mean, that just seems like that's what the evidence is suggesting. Colin, do you come down on either side of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's something where I know there have been issues in both Baltimore and Philadelphia. At least from the reporting I've seen, it does appear to be worse in Baltimore and more systemic. That's not to downplay the issues in Philadelphia, but certainly Baltimore, if you're looking at issues with the police departments, that is probably up there among the worst in the country, if not the worst from what I've seen.
Well, as reporters, Emily and Mikhail, do you guys feel like that the level of prosecution of these type of things is reflective of the actual amount of a problem there is? Or do you feel like it's, it's the few bad apples angle on it?
That's kind of a tough one. There have been problems with the Philadelphia Police Department. And again, I don't want to suggest that it's everyone. It's certainly not. But there have been problems. There are some interesting cases in the courts now about the conduct of some police. And I think it's going to take some time to really figure out what was happening back in those early 1990s. That definitely seems to have been a problematic era.
It seems like it was a problematic era for a lot of police departments. Obviously, Adnan Syed's conviction happened during that period. The mid-90s, you know, and we've struggled on the podcast to adequately convey the sense of urgency of law enforcement in the 90s because of the sort of fear that gripped everybody at that time.
I just think that's important context. Everything that was going on back at that time certainly mattered in not only the Holman case, but other cases as well.
So we've got a few more questions that aren't about the addendum. We got another one from Ann S., who says, is there any way that they can introduce Andre Dawkins' corroborating testimony in another appeal? The idea that the judge gets to decide that this time Deirdre is lying without hearing from him seems wrong.
Yeah, the answer to that is no. It was basically from the opinion I was reading from before, where they said this is a case where defense counsel on appeal was not diligent in getting his testimony, and also that it wasn't necessary to corroborate the recantation by Deirdre. And so that's a closed door. That testimony is not going to be coming in down the road.
We got another question from Justin, who says, do you think when a trial judge denies an appeal, but then the Supreme Court orders it back down to the same trial judge, does that have an effect on the outcome?
Yeah, I think you have to look at sort of two different situations that might be covered in that. So the first scenario is the Adnan Syed situation, which is Judge Welch makes an opinion when Asia McClain isn't testifying, and the appellate court later determines we have to send that back down because now we have evidence that she was possibly tampered with, and let's hear her testimony. And so that's something where the appellate court isn't saying you got it wrong. They're saying there's new information. Can you reconsider your opinion? And in that case, I think, as we saw, a judge like Judge Welch is certainly open to amending their opinion. The second would be a situation, and this is something that we've seen come up in a few cases, and it's actually going to be the next case we cover is also going to have this situation. It's where a judge issues an opinion, and then the higher court says, you got it wrong, you have errors, we're going to send it back to you to correct those errors. And I think that case is much more likely to produce a judge who digs in their heels and says, well, no, I'm not going to change my opinion. I was right in the first place. I'm not going to change what I said. So I think it really depends upon why it's being sent back down.
But if a judge does dig in their heels, what do you do then? I mean, he says, you asked me to reexamine this. I'm reexamining it. No, I was right to begin with. Then what happens?
Well, then, and that's this case we're going to be handling next. It's the Ronnie Long case out of North Carolina. It's something where the court sent it back down and the judge dug in their heels and it went back up in appeal and now it's back again. The appellate court has sent it back down to that judge to say, let's reconsider this again. And I guess you could sort of go in this vicious cycle where it keeps on going. But eventually, at some point, the appellate court will find, okay, we disagree and now the record is settled enough that we can actually now reverse you on the merits as opposed to saying you actually have to decide things so we can then review your opinion.
Okay, my head is spinning a little bit, but okay. we had another question from Jenny, who's a longtime fan. She says, why didn't the police spend more time finding the gun? Were there any deep attempts to find the real gunman? Weren't any bullet casings found at the crime scene?
That's actually one of the things that we've been wondering about. You know, somewhere out there in storage, probably somewhere, is the original Philadelphia Police homicide file. And I know defense lawyers who represent Chester Holman would really love to see what's in that file. That might answer some of the questions.
Yeah, as we just saw in the Willie Vesey case, that homicide file had information about an alternate suspect that just was never turned over to the defense. What we know here is a bullet was found in the victim that was determined to have been fired from a 38 caliber gun. The gun they recovered from Chester Holman's apartment was a 38. Now, that said, as I think Robbie mentioned on the episode, they didn't find evidence that 38 had been fired recently. And going back to the timeline that was just being mentioned, there wasn't time for Chester Holman to commit this murder, go home, drop off the gun, and then be back in the vehicle to be pulled over. So it's seems clear that that was not the gun that was used in the shooting. Now, how much of an effort the police made to find the actual shooter or the actual gun, yeah, we're not sure. We don't have the homicide file.
We also got a question from Gayla Ignacio, who says, 6 years? Why, oh, why does the injustice system take so long? What madness is this? Is it like ER triage? Is there even a system? Who determines who goes first, and why would any request for a new hearing take 6 years?
Yeah, I mean, this is just one of those procedural nightmares. I mean, this is something where, you know, Chester Holman appeals and he loses. And then he goes to the intermediate appellate court in Pennsylvania and he loses. So he goes to the state Supreme Court and loses. So then he goes in federal court. He files a petition for writ of habeas corpus saying, look, federal court say that the Pennsylvania court's got it wrong. He loses there. He appeals up to the federal appellate court. He loses there. He tries to appeal up to the U.S. Supreme Court. He loses there. And it's just, I mean, that's just think about that number of layers just to get that first appeal resolved. And then there's a whole host of other issues even after that. And it just sort of adds up each of these layers, 6 months to a year. And pretty quickly it can add up to the 6 years.
And is there any system that certain cases get moved ahead in terms of priority, or is it just as they're filed, they're dealt with?
It really depends. So, I mean, if you go sort of back to the Adnan Syed case, that is something where a case like his, there are similar cases that are resolved in 3 months. There are certain cases like his that take a year and a half. And it really just depends. Sometimes it's the luck of the draw with the judges you get. There's just a variety of issues that could lead to someone applying much later, getting relief much earlier, or vice versa.
And also, as you've pointed out in the past, Colin, you know, all these layers are trying to get their decisions exactly correct. None of them want to get overturned on appeal. They're all trying to buttress, you know, their particular ruling with points of the law. And that's just a time-consuming process. Am I right, Colin?
Yeah, no judge wants to be reversed on appeal, and they want to get it right. And most judges are diligent. They take the time to review the record and to review the law and give reasoned decisions. And yeah, that unfortunately takes time. I mean, it's fortunate in the sense that in most cases, I think judges on appeal get it right. But there are cases where I think sometimes the law is just bad. I mean, we went through sort of the history of why there's skepticism about recanted testimony. I think that's sort of terrible, the origins of that. And that has ramifications to today, where a number of cases we've covered, whether it be the Jamar Huggins case or this case with Chester Holman, where really the only evidence against the defendant is a witness who then recants, and they're just in this legal purgatory where that recantation isn't given credit.
And we've got one last question from Nick Powell, who says, has there been any update on the Joey Watkins case? I have been looking, but haven't been able to find anything. Thanks.
Yeah, so speaking of habeas petitions, that habeas petition in his case, based upon the gun evidence with the dog and the juror who did the drive test, that was filed January 16th, 2017. We were thinking, as that 1 year anniversary approached, that we would have some type of response and could proceed from there. But now you can see it's been a year and a month, and no, we're still waiting. Haven't heard anything yet. We think we have a winning argument, and it's one of those things again where it's just a waiting game.
Well, Colin, I think we've reached the end here. Do you have any questions for Emily and Mikhail?
No, I think you covered it with everything. I was really happy to have both of you on. Thanks again so much for writing this article. I was really glad that Rabia found it and we were able to, you know, follow up on your excellent work by presenting it in this podcast.
Yes, thank you guys so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. Good luck.
Thank you. And one last word to your editors. Let them run wild. I love reading their stuff. Okay. Thanks, guys. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. And that is all for the addendum this week. If you feel like checking out our website, undisclosed-podcast.com, there is, as always, a list of all of our criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to. I am donating all of my fees for this series to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and you can help them as well at their website, innocenceprojectpa.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle, @UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I want to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, once more for his research, as well as Hannah McCarthy of Partners in Crime Media for audio production, Patrick Cortez, who composed our addenda theme, and Mithil Telhan, our project manager. Thank you all, guys. You make me look good. I really appreciate it, and I can't wait to be with you all again next week.